or 11. I don't want to say one last time because it's not as if we'll never turn to John chapter 11 again over the course of time and preaching and all those kinds of things. But at least for what will be the last time in this series, we will come to John chapter 11. And believe it or not, there are a few verses of this chapter that we have yet to really look at. And so we want to do that here this afternoon. Let us read here beginning in verse number 43 like we did this morning in John 11. And read down through the end of the chapter and then we will get into what it has to say to us. And when he thus had spoken, he cried with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth." And he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes. And his face was bound about with a napkin. Jesus saith unto them, "Loose him, and let him go." Then many of the Jews which came to Mary and had seen the things which Jesus did believed on him. But some of them went their ways to the Pharisees and told them what things Jesus had done. Then gathered the chief priests and the Pharisees a council and said, "What do we? For this man doth many miracles. If we let him thus alone, all men will believe on him, and the Romans shall come and take away both our place and nation." And one of them named Caiaphas, being the high priest that same year, said unto them, "Ye know nothing at all, nor consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, that the whole nation perish not." And this spake he not of himself, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus should die for that nation, and not for that nation only, but that also he should gather together in one the children of God that were scattered abroad. Then from that day forth, they took counsel together for to put him to death. Jesus therefore walked no more openly among the Jews, but went thence unto a country near to the wilderness, into a city called Ephraim, and there continued with his disciples. The Jews' Passover was nigh at hand, and many went out of the country up to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. Then sought they for Jesus, and spake among themselves as they stood in the temple, "What think ye, that he will not come to the feast?" Now both the chief priests and the Pharisees had given a commandment that if any man knew where he were, he should show it, that they might take him. Now the theme for our last look at the resurrection and the life for today has really been the idea of the reactions to the resurrection. And here we find just a little bit more about those reactions that we saw a little bit about this morning already. As we continue to think about this tonight, we notice this morning that the passage here in John 11 is linked to all the gospel accounts of the resurrection of Christ. And it is so that as you read one, you can't help but think of the other. One points to the other, foreshadowing. One is the foundation for the other as far as being the resurrection and life. All of those things, these two passages are linked very much together when looking at it from that way. That is, the raising of Lazarus makes us think of the raising of Christ. The power of Christ makes us think of him taking up his own life by power. As we see the people's reaction to it, all of that, again, one leads to the other. But as we read these last verses, we see that they are linked even the more. Because one truly did lead to the other. And that's what we want to kind of think about for our time together here tonight. As we consider the end of this chapter, we find that the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ is not only linked because of these similarities that we've already mentioned, but it is linked because of the outcome of the raising of Lazarus was used providentially by God in his planning and purposing to bring about the conditions under which Christ would be taken and crucified. Now, certainly there were other factors that God used. There were other things that were in play or at work with the sovereignty of God. There's always more than one thing. But yet here we see a major thing. And that's not a detail that I had on recall before this, that, you know, the raising of Lazarus played a key role in how the Jews, the Pharisees, the high priest, and all of those looked at Christ, and then how that influenced all of their actions afterwards. I had never really looked at that part before. These events set in motion, or they create, if you will, a hastening, at least in the eyes of man, of the impending or the coming crucifixion of Christ. Now we know that there was a date set in time before time ever began when Christ was going to hang on the cross. We know that it was always going to be, it was always going to happen. But as we look at things, God sets things in motion in time, and He uses man, He uses circumstance, He uses all of those kind of details to bring about the eventual thing that has been appointed and prophesied, and that is what is happening here. Now, in order for Christ to be crucified, as had been foretold by all of the Old Testament prophets, He had to be executed by hanging on a tree, which wasn't by a rope from a tree, but by hanging upon a tree, being nailed to a tree. The prophecies that were mentioned in the Old Testament made that very plain. We also see that for that to happen, of course, had to be crucifixion. We also see that He had to be betrayed by His own countrymen and sold for a certain amount of price of silver. So He had to be hated both by His own countrymen, but also by an entity whose primary execution style was crucifixion. Both of those things had to happen. He had to be the enemy, so to speak, of both, or at least of one that made Him the enemy of the other as well. And so in time, that had to be worked out providentially by God. In these circumstances, the burden of the resurrection, if you will, is that these things came to be in part because of the raising of Lazarus. This event brings both the Jew and the Roman perspective together. Of course, we know the Roman government was in charge of Judea at this time. They had their Roman authorities over all the provinces. We know Caesar and we know Pilate, and all the governmental structure was in place. But what the Romans often did was when they came in and conquered a territory, they would leave in place the religion of the place. They would leave in place sometimes even the local government, if you will, as long as that religion and that government paid homage to Caesar. Ultimately, they were the authority, but they would allow them to continue in some fashion, in some form. And that's what was happening here. The Jews had all of their religion in place. They had their own hierarchy as far as the high priesthood. They had the Sanhedrin. They had all of those things that ruled their religion, that governed their life. And the Romans were fine with keeping that in place as long as they didn't try to overthrow the Roman authority, or they were able themselves to keep order within their religion. As long as those things happened, they would maintain the status quo, and those things would be good. But what we see happening here, the raising of Lazarus, brings together the Jew and the Roman perspective to where Christ will become hated by both in time. And this would be the event that sets that in motion. And really, you know, a lot of times we have a warped view, a warped sense of what the will of God is. We have a warped sense of how God works in our lives. We often think that, well, if we do good, only good things will happen. If we behave ourselves, only good things will happen. If we do the will of God, only good things will happen. But here's Christ displaying His power as the resurrection and the life. Here's Christ raising a man from the dead, and it draws the hatred of the Jews, and eventually, of course, the persecution of the Roman government. And you would think, well, if He's doing the will of God, how can that be? We need to keep in mind that doing the will of God is always what is right, but it is not always what is enjoyable. And the circumstances that are brought on here in the life of Christ Himself shows us that. Because as we've already read, once these things happened, He didn't walk anymore among His brethren. He didn't go home anymore. He didn't get around the people that He really loved until the very last week of His life, when He came back to Bethany, spent some time with Lazarus and Mary and Martha again. But then, of course, we know that week ended up with His crucifixion. And so we often think about things wrong. We often think that God has promised things to be a certain way, an outcome to be a certain way. that things won't hurt. But obviously that is not the case. Now, read with me here back in verse number 46. We know in verse 45, some of them which came to Mary, and this is an aside and something we didn't even get to, and it's something I didn't even notice till really right at the very end of this study here. You notice it doesn't say, then many of the Jews which came to Martha, or that came to Martha and Mary, but many of the Jews which came to Martha. She was able to have an effective testimony and outreach through this. I'm not saying Martha didn't, but there's a difference. Only one of the sisters are mentioned. You can chew on that and think about it a little bit. See, this passage is really never ending. But here, they believed, and then in verse number 46, as we read this morning, but some of them went their ways to the Pharisees and told them what things Jesus had done. Then gathered the chief priests and the Pharisees at council and said, what do we? For this man doth many miracles. Immediately after the raising of Lazarus, there were some that believed, but then there were others that they decided they were going to go and tell the Pharisees, who were always at odds with Christ, always the enemy of Christ. They didn't believe, they mocked, they were in unbelief. They go to the Pharisees and they say, you need to be aware of this. This man has just raised another man from the dead. It's attested to, it is a reality. This has happened and you need to know. Upon hearing of this, the Pharisees gathered the chief priests and the council. And I would interpret by what it says here, the council we know of as the Sanhedrin. They were the ones ultimately that put Christ to death, and they were the ones that had the power. And so what's described here seems to me to be the Sanhedrin was convened. That's no small matter. This was a very big deal after the Pharisees heard about what had happened. Now, Christ had performed many miracles before this. He had even brought people back to life, but not before out of the grave. He had healed the blind. He had caused the lame to walk. He had given hearing to the deaf. He had done many, turned to water into wine, we know. But this seems to be almost the last straw. Now he has raised a man from the dead. Raised a man that had been in the grave 4 days. That had lying in the grave and should be stinking and rotting. But now was up and walking around and living a life. And this seems to be the final straw. They weren't going to be idle anymore. They were worried about Christ and the power that he possessed. Clearly, their urgency is seen in verse number 47 when the question is posed to the council, what do we? For this man doth many miracles. They want to know, what are we going to do? What are our options? What should we bring to bear upon this man to take care of this problem? It was enough to make them extremely worried. And verse 48 gives us some insight into why they were worried. Notice, if we let him thus alone, all men will believe on him, and the Romans shall come and take away both our place and nation. They were worried that if Christ was left alone, that if he was unchecked, unhindered, that if they did not fight against him, or if they did not in some way keep him in check, that everybody in Judea, Samaria, Galilee, everywhere that they had power over, they were all going to believe on Christ. Isn't this an interesting thing? You're seeing this from the enemy's perspective. You're seeing this commentary coming from those that hated Christ the most and that were opposed to him religiously, saying, if we don't do something, he's going to bring everybody unto himself. That's a testament to his power. A testament to his effectiveness, and his ministry was so dynamic that they were legitimately worried about that. From their side, I say legitimately, of course. And these men had seen other religions come and go. They had seen other occult sects and religions rise up and then, of course, die out. They had seen these things happen cyclically over and over again. But this was not any man. This was the God-man. This was Jesus Christ. And now he was doing something that nobody else had ever done. He was raising men out of the grave. And so clearly they were worried. This threat was important to them. And some might be sitting here saying, well, okay, let's just say we put it in today's terminology. And we think about Christ being here on the earth and somebody's worried saying, Well, he's going to convert the whole nation unto himself. That'd be a good thing, right? Well, it would be unless you have a stake in the government. Unless your lifestyle is guaranteed by the government that's in place. Because if from sea to shining sea, America became converted to Christ, quickly, the government's going to change, isn't it? People in power are going to change. And if people in power are going to change, then the people that they fund and the people that they keep in place, the people that they support, they're also going to change. They're going to lose. And so that's what they're worried about here. In verse number, 48, he says, the Romans shall come and take away both our place and nation. If everyone converted to Christ and to Christianity, Israel, in a sense, would stop existing. They wouldn't need the Sanhedrin anymore. They wouldn't need the daily sacrifices. They wouldn't need the high priest. They wouldn't need all of this structure that they had in place. And if they didn't need that structure, the Roman government wouldn't be allowing them to have that power anymore. They would just be average Joe citizen, and then their life would be subject to the Roman power and authority instead of having the leeway, instead of having the advantages that they did now. And so they're very worried about that. They think from what they have seen that it's really going to happen. And so during this council, they're asking, what shall we do? We don't want Rome to come and take away our place. We want things to remain the same. We want the power. We want the ability that we have now. This scared them to death. And clearly from their perspective, something needed to be done. But what would that be? Now imagine yourself sitting in this, this meeting, sitting on this council, and somebody says, this man is a threat to us. He's a threat to our very existence, to the power of this council and committee. He, if he's allowed to go unchecked, is going to cause us harm. We'll lose everything. What do you think the answer? It doesn't take a genius to think that somebody is going to say, well, he's an enemy to the state. Let's just take him out. Let's kill him. Let's get him out of here. And that's exactly what Caiaphas does here in verse number 49. But there's a twist. And the twist is that Caiaphas is going to suggest killing Jesus Christ. And in doing so, he's prophesying that it should be done to appease God. But from his point of view, he's saying it, I think, differently. Verse 49, and one of them, named Caiaphas, being the high priest that same year, said unto them, ye know nothing at all, nor consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and that the whole nation perish not. Just think of that phrase, the gravity, the immensity of the statement that Caiaphas makes here. He's saying, don't you understand? It's expedient that this man should die for all of us. And it certainly is expedient that he die for all of us to save us from our sins. But that's not what Caiaphas meant. But he wasn't speaking himself. Notice in verse number 51, it says, and this spake he not of himself, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus should die for that nation. So as he was speaking, the Spirit of God was using his words to broadcast a statement, to broadcast a truth that Jesus Christ would indeed die for the sins of his people. And you have to understand here that in verse number 51, this is the narration of John, not the voice of Caiaphas anymore. When he says that he prophesied that Jesus should die for that nation, and not that nation only, but that also he should gather together in one the children of God that were scattered abroad. So Caiaphas is speaking as a mouthpiece for God here. When he says that this man should die, that we might all be saved. Now from Caiaphas's conscious perspective, he's saying that he should die to appease the Roman government. That he should die to keep us safe from reprisal from the Roman government. He's like, don't you understand that it's fitting that one should die to keep us safe? But of course, as God gave him those words, they were meant prophetically much different. That Jesus Christ would die. But you see here how God is working in the emotions, in the feelings, in the workings of the heart of these men to bring about his appointed means. And so though they thought they meant one thing, of course, the prophecy is coming down. This man should die so that not only the Jews that would believe on him, but also in verse 52, he's saying all those that would come after, all those that are scattered abroad, even us today, would be brought into the family of God by this. So the magnitude of this statement is just amazing. The way he said this without realizing that he could say it, it says that being high priest, of course, and that was on its way out, we know, with the ministry of Christ and everything, but God was still using him. I mean, in the Old Testament, God made a donkey speak on his behalf. He can do anything in this regard. Man is in his control at every turn. If you hold your place here and turn over to Acts chapter 2. So when we hear that and read that, we see Caiaphas saying, he needs to die so we can keep our positions, we can keep our government, we can keep these things. Reality, he's saying, Christ needs to die to save his people from their sins. Acts 2, verse number 22. Paul preaching unto the Israelites, or Peter, excuse me, the day of Pentecost, he says, "Ye men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man approved of God among you by miracles and wonders and signs, which God did by him in the midst of you, as ye yourselves also know." Hold it right there just for a second. Miracles and signs and wonders, one of which was the raising of Lazarus. Appointed by God. God gave him everything he needed, of course. He's God in the flesh. He raised Lazarus from the dead. And the point in raising Lazarus from the dead was approving him among the Jews, among the Israelites, but it also angered them. It also motivated them to want to kill him, as he says in verse 23. "Him being delivered by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God, ye have taken and by wicked hands have crucified and slain, whom God hath raised up, having loosed the pains of death, because it was not possible that he should be holden of it." They had taken and with wicked hands crucified and slain. Now, God did not have to make them want to. They wanted to all of their own. What God did not do was restrain that passion. He did not choose to restrain that evil. God, as it tells us in the Psalms, He restrains wrath up to a point that pleases Him, and then He doesn't restrain wrath as He sees fit. And so these men wanted to slay Christ because of what was going on. Because they were afraid they were going to lose their place. And with wicked hands, they took and crucified him because of their overwhelming desire to not be overthrown or taken away. Go back to John 11 as we move on here in these verses. Again, the whole point of this is to show how closely linked the raising of Lazarus is to the betrayal of, arrest of, and crucifixion of Christ. The outcome of this council is that they all agreed with Caiaphas. Now, if they had really understood that God was speaking and the prophecy, this would have turned out a whole lot different. But all they could see was this would solve our problems. And this is, again, the event that really turned him into the enemy of the Jews and eventually the Romans. Verse 53, "Then from that day forth, they took counsel together for to put him to death." That day forward, they decided it then. Now, if you read the other gospel accounts, there were times when Christ was mobbed and he vanished away. There were times when they pushed him back against a cliff. Again, he vanished away. It wasn't his time. Those were what you might call isolated incidents that were leading up to. Now, we see an order from the high priest, from the Sanhedrin, that he is to be put to death. He was under the order of execution, the order of death from this moment forward. You see, all of this had to be arranged in order for Christ to die on the cross. And it's not as if God made them do it. It was just their natural passions leading them in this way. If somebody comes along and threatens to take away your lifestyle, you're not going to be very happy about it. And so that is what is happening here in this time. And so this made him a wanted man, a hunted man, a watched for man. And we notice in verse 54, "Jesus therefore walked no more openly among the Jews, but went thence into a country near to the wilderness unto a city called Ephraim, and there continued with his disciples. As we read the first clause of verse 54, then Jesus walked no more openly among the Jews. Do you know how many people would say today so hypocritically to him, what, don't you trust God? Don't you trust that he's going to keep you? Don't you trust that he's going to do what's best for you? That's how we treat people when they make decisions in their life that they feel are best. And I don't want to humanize Christ to the point where we ignore his deity, but he was a man. And what we need to realize is that God gives us the ability to evaluate a situation, to make a decision, to approach, you know, through common sense, whatever the situation may be and whatever's going on. And that takes on a lot of different forms in life. We've faced that with the decisions we've had to make over the years with heart surgeries and miscarriage, all those things that have happened. And sometimes people are very critical and they say, well, don't you trust God? Just get back out there and do this or trust God and, you know, go forward in this or whatever. And some would look at Christ and say the same thing, because he walked no more openly among the Jews. There's a time when led by the will of God to draw back. There's a time to, you know, not walk openly among the people anymore for a time. I just saw that so plainly as we read this here. We need to be very careful of how critical we are of others. Now, we certainly don't read into this that Christ was scared or that he didn't trust the will of God, but simply it was the time that he no more was among them. His time would come, but it was not yet. He is doing that very thing. This is the eternal purpose in him walking where there is safety at this moment. And there's an eternal purpose in that for us as well. And so he walked no more openly among them. He, in a sense, hid himself away for a time. And what we don't see in this passage is that between verse 54 and 55, there is the passing of time. The Passover was not immediately at hand when this council was convened. It would be a while yet, and I didn't do the necessary research to tell you if that was just a couple of days, a week, 2 weeks. It was a shorter period of time, not a great length of time, that he stayed away. And then notice here in verse number 55, and the Jews' Passover was nigh at hand, and many went out of the country up to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify himself. Then sought they for Jesus, and spake among themselves as they stood in the temple. What think ye? That he will not come to the feast? Can you just imagine these men, bloodthirsty, desiring to end his life, desiring to get it all over with so that they could sleep easy at night, standing at the corner of the temple, what is the meeting place, or had been the meeting place between God and his people, whispering to one another, do you think he's going to show up? Do you think we're going to be able to take him quietly? Do you think we're going to be successful? Think we're going to be able to nip this thing in the bud and you know, take it away and not be a problem? Now, as we studied through the life of Christ, we noticed that he didn't walk any more openly among them until this week. And then even he moved between Bethany and Jerusalem carefully and cautiously until, of course, that Palm Sunday when he rode in dramatic fashion. When Christ did that, he had the people. The people were cognizant of the fact he was there. He went and taught in the temple. He was there and they couldn't take him. And as you read through the gospel accounts, you see they wanted to. The desire was there. But they were not able to because of the many people. And so they're sitting there wondering, is he going to come? And all those kinds of things. Verse 57, now both the chief priests and the Pharisees had given a commandment that if any man knew where he were, he should show it, that they might take him. That command led to Judas's betrayal, specifically, because they had made that. Anybody knows, and of course, people would understand that there'd probably be a reward with that, all that kind of thing. But this command led to Judas's betrayal. So you can see many different things in motion throughout the reaction to the raising of Lazarus that led to, hastened unto the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, where he would be taken away into Calvary when his time would come, of course, at that appointed time, at that appointed hour. And so we find the reaction here, not only in those that believed, not only in those that mocked and went and told the Pharisees, But the reaction in that there were those that were so diametrically opposed to Christ, they wanted to slay him. And you still find that reaction among people today to the resurrection. They're so opposed to it that they just want to burn it down, so to speak. I mean, they want to rid themselves of it in every way, shape, and form. They want to fight against it. There's a lot in the atheist movement that are like that, that hate anything to do with Christianity, which makes no sense at all. Because if you believe there is no God, why would you fight against something that doesn't exist? So that doesn't make any sense at all, but yet that's what they do. And so all of this ties together. This is the anchor point for Acts 2 when it talks about have taken with wicked hands, and slain. This is the anchor point for Judas finding the command or the opportunity to betray Christ. This is the anchor point for now that the Jews are riled up with Christ, they're going to present him as a threat to the Roman government. And that's exactly what they do in time to come. And so all of that molds and shapes together from the powder keg, if you will, of raising Lazarus from the dead. So what a wonderful way to end our look here to see the linking of these two so very plainly. And just as we pointed out, just seeing that detail about Mary, there's much more that, you know, you can look at and read through and reread. One of the wonderful things about studying the Word of God is that we'll never remember every detail of anything. That's not who we are. It's not how we're made. But when we take it in, it becomes a part of us. It becomes part of our DNA. We often relate it to food. We don't remember maybe what we ate a week ago Tuesday, but we took it in and it became part of us. It became part of our sustenance, our strength. It became part of our life force. It became part of who we are and gives us the ability to move on and to operate. And that's what all these things learning in John 11 has done for us. And so prayerfully and hopefully, whenever we come across them in time to come, you'll be flooded with that emotion and thankfulness for what God has shown us. And that we'll continue to learn and continue to grow in the idea and the understanding of what the resurrection is and exactly how important the resurrection is to us. And we pray the Lord will bless in that and just watch over us throughout the time to come. Lord willing, next Sunday we'll be getting into something new and may take us through the month of May at least, maybe into June, some we'll see. So we're excited about that and we just pray the Lord will bless as we get it. Let's stand. We'll be dismissed for a prayer here this afternoon.